Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm always impressed by the understanding of one of that war's most important battlefronts, often neglected, I'm sorry to say, but not by our first guest. He is Russ Dallin. He is, among other things, the president and editor-in-chief at the Latin American Herald Tribune, as well as the head of an international investment bank, Caracas Capital Markets, a man who has spent a lot of time in Latin America, including a considerable amount of it in Venezuela, a topic we return to with regularity, I'm pleased to say, to get the latest on the dire condition of that country and the implications for the rest of us. Russell Dallin, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a pleasure, sir.
The pleasure is ours. Let me ask you about this trip that Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, found it very necessary, quote-unquote, very necessary to make to communist China. Would that have something to do with the hope of floating his boat with another financial infusion from Beijing?
You hit the nail on the head once again, Frank. It is taken at the last minute as something that we've been tracking for the last 2 months and had seen read the Chinese tea leaves on this issue. I think in this case, Venezuela has become a beneficiary of realpolitik and the trade war between the U.S. and China. So suddenly, where the U.S. has asked China not to feed the gremlins, they have indeed decided to do that if they're going to be in a battle with the U.S. So Mr. Maduro suddenly took a trip yesterday to go and pick up a $5 billion check, it looks like.
Wow. Now, what we're finding elsewhere around the world, and I assume is operating with Venezuela as well, is that whatever funding the Chinese are going to be putting in, they are going to have strings attached. It's kind of like a payday loan. The costs are exorbitant, and the likelihood of default is virtually certain, and that the net result will be Venezuela will be relinquishing assets of that country, perhaps oil, perhaps their ports or airfields or other assets, to effectively control by the Chinese. Is that something that you would say is in prospect now?
Definitely so. In this case, it looks like the money will be repaid, as have others, by exports of oil. So in a sense, basically China is securing its supply lines. The money is to be used to invest in increasing Venezuela's dire oil production levels, which have fallen to just a third of what they were before the communists and Chavez came into power.
Now, let me just interrupt you to ask you, because we hear about this further diminishing of the productivity of what has been widely described as the world's most vast oil reserves. What is it that is causing this continuing, essentially, constriction of this vital wellspring of such economic wealth as the country has?
Corruption, communism, and incompetence. If you had to name three things that were sinking the Venezuelan ship, all of those three have conspired together to take that oil production from 3.5 million barrels a day to the OPEC figures that we got just hot off the press yesterday at 1.24 million barrels a day. So they have managed to destroy the golden goose. And of course, China is worried about getting paid back because it's loaned $62 billion to these idiots. And to get paid back, they have to be able to pump the oil. So China is making this out of necessity. Venezuela needs it out of necessity, but it also is a play on sticking a finger in the U.S.'s eye as well.
So as you look at what's developing here, Rust Allen, the oil supply such as it is coming out of the ground in Venezuela looks as though it increasingly will be mortgaged to the Chinese. To the extent that that winds up not working out for Maduro, as everything else basically is not working out with respect to his efforts to stave off the complete collapse of his economy, do you anticipate that the Chinese will be entering Venezuela in an even larger sense, in terms not just of their economic machinations, but their physical presence as well? And what might the implications of that be for, well, the tattered Monroe Doctrine, which told the foreign powers to stay out of our hemisphere many decades, centuries now ago, but more generally, our vital interests there?
Well, you've again tapped an important series of events that are taking place, and it's not with China. You also have the Russians heavily involved in Venezuela.
And the Iranians and the Cubans, lest we forget.
Yes, the Iranians are there, but they're a great diminished power. It's of what's, I hate to use the word great powers when describing Russia or China, but they're certainly economically, or in China's case, or armament great power in Russia's case. They are there, heavily invested, and they get the job done. The Chinese have increased production while all of Venezuela is collapsing. The Chinese have managed to increase production at their joint venture with the Venezuelans from 70,000 barrels a day to 110,000 barrels a day. So the Russians and Rosneft are the same way. They the Venezuelans may be incompetent, but the Chinese and the Russians they know how to get stuff done.
So in terms of an increased presence on the ground or ability to exercise influence at the very least, if not project power from this strategically located country in our hemisphere, Venezuela, Rust Allen, what's in prospect as you see it for our interests in the region?
Well, you've got a country with the largest oil supply in the world. It's more than Saudi Arabia. It also is one of the closest to the United States in terms of getting that oil to the U.S. market, which it had been increasingly tethered to. But now you have that oil being diverted over to Asia, even to India in Russia's case, where Russia has purchased a large refinery. And you have, at the same time, switching of armaments and technology to Chinese weapons and Russian weapons, everything from the AK weaponry to Russian Sukhoi jets to Chinese fighters and technology as well.
Rust Allen, a topic that deserves very close scrutiny. We appreciate that you are applying the resources of the Latin American Herald Tribune too, and the benefit that we're able to glean from all of that. Come back to us, if you would, very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by the great David Goldman. He is an essayist par excellence, often under the pseudonym Spengler in the Asia Times. He is also the author of a very important book, How Civilizations Die, and a man who is generous with his time to share with us his insights about matters economic, military, technological, the national interests of the United States, well, basically broadly defined. And we are always grateful for his expertise. David, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Frank. My privilege entirely. Thanks for the kind words.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about what you make of what Donald Trump is doing as we commemorate, I guess is the right word for it, mark the 25th anniversary of the so-called Oslo Peace Accords between Israel and the entity that was established by them, the Palestinian Authority. It seems 25 years on that there hasn't been a whole lot of peace, at least as far as the Palestinians are concerned, in their dealings with the Israelis. And Donald Trump seems to be taking some rather extraordinary steps to hold the Palestinians at last accountable.
Well, Frank, I think the president has handled this brilliantly. It's a triumph of common sense over diplomatic fog. The president told Jewish leaders in a conference call before the Jewish New Year that by moving the embassy to Jerusalem, he had taken that issue off the table and, in fact, made negotiations possible. Everyone told him he couldn't do it because it would hurt negotiations. The president said exactly the opposite is true. You can only have negotiations once Jerusalem is off the table, because that sends a message to the Palestinians that Israel, the Jewish state, will be there forever. And their entire game has been to tell their own people, don't worry, we'll get rid of Israel, while telling the West we want to negotiate so they can get all of the aid. The next step is to eliminate this monstrous United Nations Works Relief Agency, which is the only aid agency set up by the UN to deal with one class of so-called refugees, namely Palestinians. And of course, the Palestinians are the only people in the world where the great-grandchildren of refugees are also considered refugees. That applies to no one else in the world.
You know, it's interesting, David, since you mentioned that, just to interject for a moment, the the UNRWA, as it's called by its acronym, is also, it seems, in the business, unique in the world, not of resettling and ending the travails of a refugee population, but of perpetuating them, seemingly endlessly. And as you say, generation upon generation upon generation are considered to be refugees. So the president has essentially cut the funding on that operation. And most recently, he's done something here in the United States as well. Talk about that.
Well, the president has also told the PLO that if it doesn't start negotiating with the Israelis, it's going to lose the status of its representation in the United States. So we'll have to pick up and leave. All of this is absolutely brilliant because the use of the so-called Palestinian refugee population as a hostage population whose point is to challenge the existence of the state of Israel makes negotiations impossible. The president has cut through this, and he's done a smarter and better job than the whole cast of diplomats and pundits who've loused this up since the Oslo agreements. So the idea that the president is incompetent or stupid or ill-informed is completely ridiculous. He's done a brilliant job here, and I give him an A++.
I wonder if you might address yourself to a sort of corollary idea that our mutual friend Dr. Daniel Pipes has been discussing for some time, which is the idea that peace actually will only be achieved if the Palestinians recognize, and indeed we do, and others as well, the reality that Israel has actually had a victory over the Palestinians, and that what is being done here is essentially establishing terms by the victor over the defeated, and not a negotiation between equals that has, as the past 25 years have demonstrated, absolutely no prospect of success at all. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what the president has done follows Daniel Pipes' idea pretty much exactly. What the Palestinians have done is to refuse to admit that Israel is a permanent presence. In other words, they were indeed defeated in the 1948 War of Independence and their subsequent attempts to destroy the Israeli state, and the intifadas and other wars and so forth. And by moving the embassy to Jerusalem, pulling the plug on UNRWA, challenging the permanent refugee status of generations of Palestinians and their descendants, the president has, in effect, done exactly that. He's told the Palestinians, you have lost. It's like King Arthur talking to the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He's had all of his limbs cut off. He's saying, look, you're looting. You've been beaten. So the Palestinians are now boxed into a corner. The only reason they haven't folded up immediately is because the Europeans have hastened to provide aid, or promised to provide aid, that the United States has cut, and tried to give them something of a lease on this bizarre fraud.
Somewhat similar to the role the Europeans are playing unhelpfully with the Iranians in the aftermath of the president's sensible withdrawal from the this so-called Obama bomb deal. And David, there's so much to talk with you about, and we always run out of time before we run out of topics, but I did want to switch gears, if I could, after that very helpful explication of what's going on with the Palestinians at the moment, to talk about China, a subject that you address regularly in your Asia Times Spengler column. China, I was just discussing with our previous guest, Russ Nallen, is very actively involved in lots of places around the world, including in our own hemisphere, Venezuela. Much of it follows a pattern, which we've discussed week after week, of sort of using economic power to effectively enslave populations and nations that have assets or resources or both that the Chinese wish to bring under their dominion. Talk a little bit about this phenomenon and specifically the how this debt trap machinery works to, among other things, create strategic power projection capabilities for the Chinese.
Well, China has $2 trillion worth of reserves. And for countries like Venezuela or Pakistan or Afghanistan, which are effectively broke, or Turkey, relatively small amounts of money, $5 or $10 billion at a time, can effectively buy them strategic entry. The Chinese play a game called Go. It's not like checkers. It's like checkers in several dimensions, but it involves long-term strategic encirclement. The Chinese are building assets all over the world in places that they can use to put pressure on us and possibly hurt us, from Venezuela to Pakistan to their development ports in Sri Lanka to their promise to help bail out our adversary, Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, who's now in a financial crisis, and of course their deployments in the South China Sea. The Chinese are developing the options to oppose the United States strategically, not anytime soon, because they know we're much more powerful than they are, but in 10 or 20 years, they want to be able to pressure the United States in a number of key theaters, and they're building up assets to do so.
And these assets will, in due course, I fear, be used not just to advantage them in the region, but against us and our vital interests as well. There's the matter of the trade negotiations with the Chinese. This tariff war, as it's been called, is sort of dominating the headlines. But give us your current reading, David Goldman, on what is going on, and more to the point, not going on with respect to the Chinese challenge in this domain.
American businesses have warned the president that most of the $500 billion of goods that we import from China cannot easily be produced in the United States. For example, Apple has said the iPhone can't be made in the United States because a lot of skilled labor is involved that simply has never been trained up in the United States. It would take years to do that. So the danger is that we end up paying a great deal more for that $500 billion in product and import the same thing. My view is this is a high-tech war of leapfrogging, and that we should fight it the way we fought the Cold War under Reagan, with defense-led R&D projects for key technologies which will maintain our military dominance and also have civilian spin-offs. So it looks like the administration is trying to find another way than a tariff war, which, in my view, might not at all succeed in meeting the president's objectives, which I wholeheartedly support. And I hope consideration will be given to a broader strategy of fighting directly for technological dominance.
Well, I certainly agree with that, David Goldman. And my only concern is that things have gotten so parlous in the defense research and development sector that it may be hard for the defense industry to provide that kind of leadership, but it needs to come from somewhere, that's for sure. And it seems as though places like Google are not willing to work for the Defense Department, at least their employees are not. But we'll be talking about this with you, I know, in the days ahead. Thank you for your time today and for the terrific work you do at Asia Times. Check out as well David Goldman's terrific book, How Civilizations Die. Talk with you soon.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by a man I've had the privilege of working with and admiring greatly for a long time. He is Daniel Gallington. He has served in a whole host of capacities in the United States government, notably as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Territorial Security, Special Assistant to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a General Counsel, bipartisan General Counsel at that, to the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He served as a member of the U.S. delegation to the Nuclear and Space Talks. He was an Air Force officer, and it goes on and on. These days, he is a professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Daniel Gallington, welcome back. After that big buildup, you're going to have to really rock the house, and I know you will. We've got a lot of important things to talk with you about. So, Dan, in particular, one of the things that I've appreciated about your service to our country is your work on the national security portfolio, and specifically your understanding, deep understanding of sort of nuclear deterrence-related issues, especially our posture with respect to deterring foreign adversaries. And I wanted to visit with you specifically about what we're seeing happening at the moment, where reportedly 300,000 troops are involved in exercises, including apparently nuclear warfighting exercises in Russia, and drawing in for the first time, apparently, significant numbers of Chinese forces as well. What do you make of what these, well, I think of them as adversaries, at the very least, if not outright enemies, are up to?
Well, you know, first of all, I think, as you know, not many Americans realize that for many, many years, 50 years, the Russians, the formerly the Soviets, have always used the exercise scenario as a way to kick off the real thing. In other words, they use it as a cover, and they practice it as a cover. So not only are we seeing an exercise, this massive thing that involves nuclear forces, we're seeing what a real beginning of a war would look like.
The military, I think, both here and there, practice, if they're sensible, the adage, train as you intend to fight. And this brings really home what they're up to.
Yeah, I saw, too, where they launched some bear bombers against Alaska. Our friend Mark Schneider pointed out that they really have the capability now, with the standoff missiles, nuclear-armed missiles they have, to do an attack against Alaska, for example, without even leaving Russia.
And Dan, one of the things that we believe increasingly these forces will be equipped with, and I don't know if this is the particular standoff missile that Mark is talking about, but in the not-too-distant future, it will certainly include hypersonic missiles. And one of the things that we learned in a briefing before a number of us last week given by two undersecretaries of defense and the director of the Missile Defense Agency is that these hypersonic missiles may be usable in a sneak attack that we would not see coming, and against which we currently do not have any defenses. Talk a little bit about the makeup of the Russian and Chinese strategic nuclear threat these days, and what it tells us about a level of danger that, as you say, I think most Americans are oblivious to.
Yes, but you know, it's a little bit ironical to begin such a discussion with the following proposition, and that is we know less today about Russian strategic forces and about Chinese nuclear capability. We know less today than at any time during the Cold War. We know less about their forces, their force structure, their actual numbers of certain kinds of weapons, their capabilities. And conversely, they know more about our force structure, lack thereof, than at any time during the Cold War. So there's an informational gap here that's dramatic. We think, for example, I heard Adam Smith say the other day that we think the Chinese have 500 nuclear weapons. We have no idea. They could have 5,000 and we wouldn't have a clue. Hypersonics, absolutely. This country's always been vulnerable to sneak attack. It's our history. These things travel so fast that we have no defenses that would be effective against them. And we are way, way behind the Russians in the development of these systems.
Yeah. Well, again, it's one thing to have defenses that would be effective against them. And you're right. I think we don't at the moment. According to the Undersecretary of Defense for Research Engineering, Mike Griffin, we may not even see them coming our way, which makes altogether more problematic the idea of defending against them, of course.
That's the whole concept behind them, the usability in a sneak attack scenario. That is, you can't see them coming.
And Dan, what you just made such an important point. Of course, we're talking to a fellow who served, among other capacities, in territorial defense at the Defense Department and on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence as its general counsel. This idea that we could possibly be less clued up, informed, and confident in our assessments of the order of battle of the Russians and Chinese in this post-Cold War world probably, again, would seem to most Americans to be unbelievable. I mean, we're often encouraged to have this notion that our intelligence capabilities are omniscient, that we know everything. We can read license plates from space and But here you're telling us that the Chinese could have a factor of 10 more nuclear warheads than this chap who's the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee says they do. And we wouldn't be, the wiser for it. And why is that? Is that because of this so-called underground Great Wall that they've created, 3,000 miles of hardened tunnels in which this stuff may be stashed, or for other reasons, or both?
That's the primary deceptive method used in China, both China and Russia, as the deep underground basing and hiding of their strategic capabilities. And as I say, we have no clue. We really have no clue. But Frank, this goes way back. When I remember George Tenet, who was director of the CIA, describing our surprise at the Indian and Pakistani nuclear tests in the 90s. His words were, it caught us flat-footed. Oh my gosh, this was back in the days when our overhead reconnaissance was second to none. And we have now deep underground basing and essentially harboring lots of strategic systems.
Even in Korea now, it seems, and probably Iran too. Hey, Dan, I did want to address in a little bit more detail Adam Smith. As I say, he's the top Democrat on a very important committee in the House of Representatives, its Armed Services Committee. He's quite likely, if the House does change hands to become the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And in addition to dramatically lowballing the threat from China, he made in remarks, I believe, to a group that our friend Peter Husey convened, some rather extraordinary comments about what he thinks is needed in terms of our deterrent against these sorts of threats from Russia and China. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, when you say Adam Smith, I immediately thought of the famous economist that had great insights. I realized right away that's not the guy you're talking about. And Frank, if this guy does become the chairman of the HASC, the House Armed Services Committee, let's hope that he becomes a lot better and more informed than he obviously is now. His comments the other day, I mean, they bordered on this negligent understanding of the fundamentals. Let me just give you one example. He thinks that cost has to do with the nuclear modernization costs have to do with the number of warheads. That's a very small part of it. It's the infrastructure that we've allowed to atrophy. That's what's expensive. We got to build up our infrastructure and modernize it and bring it out of the 1960s and 1970s into the current age. And that's where the big money is, and that's what we have to spend.
But Dan, let me just interrupt you to say, what the thrust of his message, as I understand it, was that we don't need anything like the kind of triad that we've had in the past, as they say, land-based missiles, airborne weapons, and submarine-based missile systems. And Dan, you mentioned the 60s and 70s. We worked together in the 1980s when President Reagan was busily modernizing all three legs of those deterrent forces. And we're still living off of the investment that he made to the extent that many of those systems now, what is it, 30-odd years on, are obsolescing, reaching, you know, not just their design life, but now well past it in some cases, especially the warheads themselves. Dan, there's so much more to talk about. We are very much out of time at the moment, though, and we'll have to do this again very soon. In the meantime, I thank you for your cumulative and extraordinary service to our country and that you're continuing to render, among other things, by teaching young Americans the matters of the law at the University of Illinois Law School. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Dinah West right after this.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Dinah West, an amazing intellect and raconteur and historian and analyst, pundit, columnist, blogger, a woman of many parts. In short, a great ally and resource of the Secure Freedom Radio team, and we're always delighted to have her with us. She's the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings these days at The Daily Caller from time to time, among other places, and also, of course, at DinahWest.net. Dinah, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Wonderful to be with you.
You have been writing up a storm about a subject that has, well, received considerable attention, but not much critical analysis, I think it's fair to say, and that is Bob Woodward's newest screed. I believe it's called Fear. Talking about Donald Trump and his administration, his presidency, his White House in, well, the most scathing terms, I think it's fair to say. Remind us where Bob Woodward comes from and help us understand how that may be shaping his analysis of the Trump presidency.
where Bob Woodward comes from. Bob Woodward comes from the 1970s Watergate scandal, as depicted, as brought to you by the Washington Post under Benjamin Bradlee. And it's hard to imagine, but this is almost ancient history at this point. But what's important to understand is that Richard Nixon was driven from office by the Washington Post, among other media organizations, driven to resign over this scandal known as Watergate. And to make a very long story short, what drew me back to this scandal was an amazing revelation that I had not seen when it first came out around 2012 that had to do with Ben Bradlee, the legendary editor, expressing extremely grave doubts about Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein's super secret anonymous source, Deep Throat. And this came in the course of an interview that he, or kind of an aide memoir, a live aide memoir he was doing with someone assisting him with his memoir in 1990. And the exact, first he talks about Watergate as really a blip, quote, a blip in history, except for Nixon's resignation, which should give people a turn. But then he's talking about Deep Throat, this very famous super secret source. And he says, there's a residual fear in my soul that that isn't quite straight. Now, this is kind of an incredible admission that did not go into his own memoir, which he was preparing with these series of assisted interviews back in the 1990. Another researcher comes along, a very favored son, who actually was put onto it by Bob Woodward and close enough to Ben Bradlee to be given Ben Bradley's papers. He comes along 20 years later in 2010 and finds this and wants to go to press with it in preparation of a biography about Bradlee. The writer is Jeff Himmelman, and indeed he brought it out. And thereby starts this series of events that was written about in 2012 in New York Magazine, which I have reposted in absolute astonishment, through which Bradlee and Woodward and this writer Himmelman all discuss what will happen when this is released. And what is fascinating to see is Bob Woodward melts down for days over the thought that Ben Bradlee's fear in his soul over Woodward's and Bernstein's key source was going to ruin him, ruin Watergate, ruin the Washington Post, and the rest of it. And it really has to be read to be appreciated, because this is an extreme case of somebody unraveling. And when you think about it, how can it be over little details? There has to be something greater there. And so I call this the fear in Bob Woodward's soul. Now, he sold nearly 1 million copies in week one of his new book. So I don't know. I feel that's a big padding. But this has to be taken into account. This is not the first time either that his reporting has been questioned. And there are a number of other cases whereby, you know, the deathbed interview of William Casey comes to mind, whereby singular fundamentals of stories that are anonymous or sourced to someone dying are called into question. And so this is, I think, how we have to always approach Woodward's work.
Right. Diana West, you talk about in one of your recent pieces six different instances, the deathbed scene with Bill Casey being one of the most prominent. But just very quickly, walk us through not necessarily all of the details of the six, but maybe just tick them off quickly. And then what's the common denominator here in terms of the reportorial technique, shall we say, that has to call into question the integrity as well as the conclusions that this guy relentlessly pushes out with the benefit of essentially all of the mainstream media and much of the elite on both sides of the aisle, let it be known.
Yes. Well, this would be, of course, the Deep Throat, which we now have from Ben Bradlee as being a doubtful issue. You have the deathbed scene of William Casey. Also, George Tenet's, if you remember the WMD, quote, slam dunk quotation, which Tenet contested. There was also a story about Justice William Brennan, that you had Anthony Lewis, the liberal left-wing New York Times column back in the day, strongly contesting. You have a Reagan recovery scene that his doctor contested. You also have from Hollywood when Bob Woodward wrote about John Belushi, the comedian, also contested by numerous Hollywood personalities who knew Belushi. So you have kind of a variety of strongly contested stories. Now, I would say, as a reporter who basically grew up in Washington, and certainly in, you know, as a young adult growing up here, I would say that each Bob Woodward book was an event. They were frequent, it seemed, a spectacle. And I think that as a reporter, now certainly on the conservative side of this aisle, however, they were always viewed as, well, was it real? Was it not? I mean, you would look at it and you would know that some of it was good and some of it was bad. And you would sort of wait to see how the people who are being written about reacted before you actually took anything very seriously. And I think that that's an important rule of thumb. However, now in the Trump period, all the problematic issues of Bob Woodward's reporting, which has gone back decades now, all of that's wiped away because the media wants to use it as a battering ram against Trump. And so now Woodward is this sterling reporter who's never had anything go wrong or call for retraction and the rest of it. So again, we're looking at a political hatchet being used, and all of a sudden Bob Woodward is the most steady-as-you-go reporter who ever lived, and it's absolutely ridiculous. That is not his reputation, and it's not his record.
Yeah. Well, so let's just take a few minutes then to talk about what he is saying about the Trump presidency, and whether, as I perceive it at least, this amounts really to political warfare against not just the president, of course, but the people that would be essentially, let's be honest, running, whether they want to or not, as proxies for Donald Trump in the fall elections. They will be, of course, on the ballot, not the president, but the president's record and their relationship to him will be very much central to their challengers' stances. Let's, I think, generalize perhaps a little bit, but I think that's reasonable to say. And to the extent the president has been, in this way, diminished by Bob Woodward, and then this companion piece, as I think of it, in the New York Times, Anonymous's companion piece, where does this leave us, Diana West, in terms of the truth with respect to the president and the electoral implications of all this political warfare?
Well, I think it leaves us nowhere with the truth with respect to the president. I think that's a completely separate issue. What we are watching is this narrative shift from the Russia investigation to the question of whether President Trump is fit to remain president. This becomes a new battering ram. They have not been able to expose anything having to do with these other manufactured scandals. And so I think that the Woodward book, the Anonymous piece, and a lot of the invective and rhetoric that we are hearing, completely abandoning all these previous narratives against Donald Trump, are now speaking to basically his management style, which is exactly what Americans voted for. And it's also speaking to this notion that his policies themselves are not fit. And yet these are exactly the policies that he ran on and that he was given a mandate to execute.
We have to leave it at that, my dear. We are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so with you next week. Thank you for your time today. Diana West, it's always a delight. Keep up the good work you do at dianawest.net and The Daily Caller and elsewhere. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Same time, same station tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.